Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with Elizabeth Hamilton Garino and Chris Fuller, helping you and people across the globe live life to the fullest. Our focus is on you, so you can be your best and create the life you deserve. Visit us at besteveryou.com.
If you are an athlete or parent of an athlete, Joe Spurley, professional sports and baseball trailblazer and one of the top coaches in the nation, shares with you the roadmap to succeeding in your sport and avoiding the pitfalls through his 40 years of sports playing and professional coaching experiences and founding the Freedom Pro Baseball Minor League. So Joe is with us today to share compelling stories of success and an athlete's roadmap that will illustrate what it takes to play sports at the high school, college, and professional level. He's here with his new book, Athlete's Guide to Success, A Roadmap to Becoming a Champion. Welcome, Joe, to the Best Ever You Show.
Thank you, Elizabeth. It's great to be on with you. I'm excited to share all the things in the book, and hopefully we can help a lot of athletes continue to play sports and have positive life-developing experiences.
Well, I have firsthand experience with you through all of the wonderful things that you've done touching our life as a baseball family. So it's really special to see you put this book out into the world. How's it going so far?
It's been really good. We've got some really good feedback, reviews. I really have been happy with it. You know, I had a soccer mom that I just talked with, and she said she's really learned a lot from it. On her second child, the first child, she, I think, went down the wrong path, but she's was real thankful for it. So it's been really good. You know, my hope is that we can get this in as many athletes and parents. You know, it's just as much for parents to understand and read. You know, you, Elizabeth, as being a mom of you know, athletes and boys, and you've been involved. It's real important, I think, to be, you know, educated and understand things that you can help, you know, your child, your boy or girl.
Yeah. Did you say soccer? I heard you say soccer in our baseball world. You said soccer.
Yeah. She actually said to me, she was working at a bookstore where I was doing a signing, and she bought a couple. And then later on, after she read it, she told me that if she had read that my book before her older daughter was down the soccer, you know, competitive, traveling everywhere and spending, you know, money, that she wouldn't have to work at the bookstore.
It's a valid point there. You know, we have four boys here, and we've done just about everything in every sport, and times have changed. So it's really neat that you've written this book to help us navigate. And what we're going to talk about today to everybody listening is to help really athletes and their parents understand what it takes to play sports at not only the high school level, but also the college and professional levels. Now, and we've got some other things we'll talk about too, but that strikes a chord with me. To help people play sports at the high school level, isn't that just, you know, I'm going to play devil's advocate here a little bit. Isn't that just a given? You can play in high school?
Yeah, you know, it used to be that way, but now it has become so competitive with a lot of tournament teams out there. They're playing so much, so these schools have so many, you know, boys and girls come out for the sports. And as I put in the book, that, you know, 70% of boys and girls age 13, 14 and older are no longer playing the sports because of burnout, overuse injuries, too much pressure, not having fun, poor development coaching. You know, which was really eye-opening for me. I witnessed that a lot, doing a lot of individual, you know, pitching and hitting lessons and mentoring that I did with, you know, baseball players. But when I saw that by the National Alliance, by U Sports, and the NCAA had a similar study out there, I thought, you know, we need to really change that in any way we can to, you know, continue to play and you know, have fun. And I think playing sports, you know, the fun has been taking out of it, and what really it was started 4 years ago, you know, and wanting to bring that back. So I have seen a lot of and heard a lot of stories of talented athletes that didn't even go out in high school. They were so burnt out and tired of playing, you know, year round. Another kind of fallacy and misunderstanding is that, you know, you need to play more than one sport, during the year. And you know, the 2018 NFL draft, 226 of the 259 players drafted all played more than one sport as a youth and in high school.
Wow. What's a well-rounded athlete to you? What's that mean? Like a well-rounded student athlete?
I think number one first, as I've always, you know, coached and mentored is, you know, schoolwork, having a good, you know, academic study, discipline, skills first, and then having, you know, passion, discipline, and really, you know, have focus skills, high character, have good, you know, self-esteem, and be a good teammate. You know, if you're playing in team sports, is you know, a good athlete that's really, you know, and coachable, that wants to learn and wants to listen. That's a very important thing that I think that parents and athletes need to understand is that you have to be very coachable and open-minded and understand and listen, because, you know, there is some statements you see out there that says if your child's uncoachable, there's a good chance they're unhirable. You know, which
that's a good thing.
I'm sure, you know,
say that one more time.
If your child is uncoachable, there's a good chance in their adult life they will be unhirable.
That makes sense.
You know, they will not want to listen and be supervised and learn. And, you know, that is a big part of, you know, as I shared in the book, is, you know, the mentoring is a part that if an athlete is going down a road of not knowing the path, he's going down this, there's no map, and he's just following, you know, and the mom or dad's following what they think is right. And not having somebody that truly has been down that path and cares and understands and can help guide you is a very important thing that I can't stress that enough. You know, in the first chapter, I talk about that and the importance of having a mentor that really can lead you down and save you from those pitfalls. Cause you know, there's been great stories and there's great, you know, high school, you know, college tournament teams, but there's also a high amount of ones that aren't really in it for the athlete, and it's more win at all costs. And, you know, it's really detrimental to the athlete.
You see these athletes in high school playing on summer teams, spending thousands of dollars with camps and lessons. And I'm sure you know more than I do. I just kind of see mm-hmm. what I see, right. You know, you can go on right. and on there, but is right. that all really necessary?
No, you know, that you're better off at times to take a break and just get away from it, instead of having burnout and overuse injuries. You know, there's studies by the orthopedics, Dr. James Andrews, who does a lot of, you know, elbow and shoulder surgeries of baseball players from age all the way to the major leagues, said that the 60% of his surgeries are age 13 to 18, and it's from overuse of playing year round of baseball. And I think that this, you know, protocol that is kind of out there in the sports world is not true. A good, really good analogy of that for the listeners, if you've ever heard of Stephon Curry, is one of the top NBA players. Well, his dad played at Virginia Tech and then was an NBA star. And then Stephon didn't have nobody was recruiting him, not even Virginia Tech. So then his friends and teammates started playing on these AAU tournament teams and playing all these, you know, year round. And so his dad, Dell, took him out of those and just had him play with, you know, with his dad and shoot and just work on his skills and not, you know, being traveling around and spending all the time and getting burnt out. And he just, the last 2 years of high school, that's what he did other than playing a high school team. And then Davidson College was the only school to give him an opportunity. And now he becomes one of the greatest shooters ever to play in the NBA. And his last 2 years in high school, he never played on the AAU in the protocol teams. His dad was wise enough and had, you know, understood it, had been down the path, obviously, of being an NBA player, and saw what was happening and pulled them out of that. And that's an amazing story. I mean, anybody an NBA player, Stephen Curry is he can shoot the lights out. I mean, there's times that you can't stop him. So those 2 years that he just worked on his own skills of shooting with his dad rather than traveling all around worked. And I think that's a great story.
Why are so many kids, players, whatever you want to call the term, why are so many people overlooked like that?
I think what happens is that there's so many out there, and the coaches really don't have the time. They're restricted on the amount of time that they can recruit. They're so, you know, busy with their games and their practices. There's so much coming at them that they're just, you know, not being seen and recruited. You know, that's amazing when you think about an NBA son player and usually an alma mater like Virginia Tech, you know, big school would have signed Stephon just because his dad was a player and then went on and played in the NBA. But it really is kind of a thing that parents need to understand. I hear a lot of times, you know, parents will say, you know, well, it comes to a certain point, you know, when they're playing, and then if they're good enough, you know, they'll be found. You know, that is a, you know, years ago that maybe was like that, but it's not like that anymore. There's just so many out there, and you have to be proactive and you have to really understand how to reach out. And I wrote a chapter about that and of looking for colleges to play that fit your academic and your career that you want to play.
Do you think the climate out there is for the love of money or for the love of the sport and playing? Why are so many people so interested in playing at the college levels or above what, and really realistically, how many people make it to the pros?
Right. A very good question. Yes. I think that it is really taking sports to a level that is really taking the fun out of it is the dollars, the love of the money, I firmly believe, you know, a tournament team, if you're playing and developing and you're getting, you know, some guidance on if your goal is to play in high school and college, you know, that those are great. But as I wrote in the book, I've seen many times where that isn't the case, that it was a win at all costs. It was a coach that really had, you know, figured out that if I do five of these tournament teams and I have 15, 20 players on a team and, you know, charge them X amount of dollars, you know, I can have a lot of fun. And then a lot of them are dads, and then their son, they can write the lineup and control that. And then they end up, you know, also, you know, having their unfulfilled days. I put that in the book also that, you know, that we have to, parents let their unfulfilled, you know, playing days go and just enjoy the time. But I think that the number one thing seems to be in my years of doing this and writing the book and study for the book was that they want a college scholarship, because I think college has become so expensive. So they start to hear these stories that, you know, it really helps. But if you don't have somebody that really is guiding you and mentioning you've been down there, I had players that I was doing, you know, when these showcases really start coming about, Elizabeth, in around 2000, when there was, you know, all these different organizations were coming up with these showcases that they were advertising that there was going to be college recruiters there was going to be professional scouts, and I started to go to a few of them, and some of these players I was given instruction that I remember we went from one in San Diego. He was like a, you know, 4-0 student, and he pitched a perfect game, you know, was set a school record, went 11-1, and ended up at the showcase, got a piece of paper that was basically like a college or a professional tryout evaluation that pitched in, you know, down the bullpen and had a radar gun readings. And his dad went all over it, even to some of the colleges that he wanted to go to. And at the end of his, before his senior year, he had no offers. And they probably had spent well over $20,000 at least just traveling around with these showcases. So I made a call to Cal Lutheran recruiting coordinator, and they ended up signing him, and he went over there, you know, and played. So So it seems that there's too much dangling of the carrot that's creating this, that they need to understand that sports is about life developing experiences and learning, you know, skills, and not having the number one goal while your child's playing sport is to get a college scholarship or to get that professional contract where you have these high signing bonuses. I mean, it's a great goal to have, but when you solely are just thinking of that, and I think a lot of parents are putting pressure. I've heard stories and I've been around hearing parents say, you know, we've put a lot into this, you better make sure and get a college scholarship. That type of pressure does not work. Yeah.
No,
go ahead.
Plus you can have spent your college scholarship traveling around. You know, by the time you get there, you know, you're 40 grand in the hole with whatever it is.
Right.
That you've tried to get everybody's attention for. It makes no sense to me.
Right. You're better off to put it into a fund and just have them, you know, your son or daughter just, you know, playing, you know, 2-3 sports and just, you know, playing in, whether it be, you know, club or high school or, you know, some city community leagues. I think we need to bring back these city community leagues where there's, you know, great, you know, friendships are built, camaraderie. They, you know, they go to a snack bar. It doesn't matter what, you know, when they're younger, they win or lose. Afterwards they go have a snow cone, or, you know, I think that I'd really like to see that. I've been helping promote some of these community leagues because some of the tournament teams are telling the boys and girls and their parents that they shouldn't play in these leagues, that they need to play in these tournament teams and play in these tournaments in order, if they want to play in high school and college, which that saying that is totally, the numbers prove it, that it's just very rarely works when you do that.
Yeah, we did a little bit of the AAU type summer leagues, but, you know, our Cam mostly played Legion and got the Legion scholarship and everything. So there's a lot of things locally that I think people overlook.
Right. That Legion was a great program, and it still is going in certain smaller areas like you mentioned, and they need to bring that back more, you know, and things to where it's more of a community, you know, like, you know, Little League, you know, Pop Warner, there's, you know, YMCA basketball. Yeah, there's all these good, you know, community youth organizations that really are a good place to have your son or daughter, you know, play sports and really develop and have a lot of fun. You know, I think the fun has been taken out of it, you know, and about age 14, 15 is when they start to feel that. And, you know, unfortunately, I've had some, you know, parents that just really, unfortunately, cry because their son or daughter says, I'm done playing. And that's, we want to stop that from happening. You know, that's one of the reasons was put in, you know, my email address and my website is to, you know, don't let your son or daughter quit playing sports because of a bad, you know, situation. Just, you know, email me or, you know, let me know and we can talk through that, because I've helped a lot, you know, that were cut, you know, and that quit. And one that I share in the book that is a real compelling story of a very talented, you know, young man that loved the game. He always said he wanted to be a professional player. And in junior year high school, he was cut. And it hit him so hard that he didn't want to go to school. He wanted to quit school. And his mom said, you know, talked him into, and called me and asked, she made him go work after school at a Subway and to just to share with the parents that this can happen. He was so upset that he didn't even want to talk about baseball, standing in line ordering the sub. And he's like, nope, coach, I'm done. And then I'm like, I knew he had an exceptional thing. I had trained him when he was 12, 13, 14. And then he veered off on these tournament teams and didn't come back. And then he went and played in high school his freshman, sophomore year. And then he got cut his junior year. And the thing, it took me the third time, Elizabeth, till he finally sat down, took his break. I asked him and I said, look, I said, we can't let one man stop you from making a decision if your dream has been to play professional baseball. And he said, let me think about it. He texted me a few days later. We set a time to go on the field and we started playing catch. And it was like he had just has a whole new life. His smile came back. It was all that. And we drew up a throwing program for him and worked with him weekly, gave him, you know, homework. And that summer we got him on a team, and he hadn't touched the ball in 2 years, got him on a summer collegiate team. And just the coach, I called him and said, he said, what does he need? I said, he just needs innings. I said, he hasn't thrown in two years. And I said, I know you're the type of guy that you're not going to go out there to win this summer league. He said, no, I'm not in it for that. And I said, well, that's why. He'll be a great fit. And he ends up, I remember his mom called and said the umpire just turned after he struck out eight and two innings and said, in three innings, said, is anybody videotaping this? And these were college players that were at home for their freshman, sophomore, and junior year, and he hadn't touched the ball. And it was incredible to see. And then I went and got him a tryout with a community college. He signs there and becomes an all-star and goes to Utah Valley, Division I school, and flies around. Opening weekend, he flies to USC, the number one baseball World Series championship school in the United States, flies in there from Salt Lake City, comes in the sixth inning, gets out of the jam. Then they win it. He goes back, flies back to Utah. They fly to Sacramento. He starts the game against University of Stockton, gets his first win. He goes on and just flies all over the country and gets a four-year education, has zero debt. Yeah.
Beautiful.
Had I not stopped into that Subway those times, he would have probably went to University of Arizona State, got a business degree like he has now, probably had $80,000 to $100,000 debt, never had ever touched a baseball game.
That's amazing. And is he someone who, you know, what's his take on the book and his experience with you and all those things? Where is he now?
Yeah, he right now is working. We were looking at things for him. He, unfortunately, his senior year, he started to have some control issues. And this is another thing that I address in the book. He's another example of when you have a son or daughter that's playing a sport in college, always remember that sometimes these college coaches don't have the ability to develop or fix the problem. Like in his case, he was having issues of being able to get his fastball and his changeup over. And it was just things that I could have straightened out with him, but his mom and dad kind of thought that, well, that he's at college now, they should be able to fix him. So you really have to, if somebody that you've worked with, your child has worked with, even though they go to college, they should still, when they have time, if they come home or in the off season, do instruction with them, because he was a prime example of that. Because his 2 years at Utah Valley, he did okay his first year. Second year, he just hit a wall. And I was at one game and I tried to tell him a little bit after the game on the sideline, but I needed to spend about 2 hours with him. And unfortunately, he ended up kind of just lost control in his stats. And
yep.
So it's a big thing to remember that I think some parents have said, well, if I send them to college, I shouldn't have to have, you know, somebody doing personal instruction with them. But that's not true, because there is times that, you know, it takes a lot. And a lot of times coaches just look at players in the overall picture and they don't have experience, like in this case, to help him be able to, you know, be throw strikes. You know, both coaches just couldn't fix them.
Well, I think the other key sentence there is, I sent you to college. You know, if you've got all your,
right,
you're at college and you've put all your eggs into the baseball, you know, basket, you could be kind of missing some of the point.
Right. Exactly. It's about an education and it's, you know, of
but he's thankful
preparing
for
yourself
that business degree
for life. Right. Yeah. All of his friends and ex-teammates that he played with since he's five, a lot of them, I followed them. They ended up veering off and not coming back for instruction and went and played in term teams. And some played in high school and some didn't. And very few played in college. He was one of the very few. And this was a talented group that he was, both little leagues in the area where he grew up. The one that I talk about in the book went all the way to San Bernardino in the semifinals in the Western region and lost to Hawaii. Hawaii went on and won the U.S. Little League World Championship. Yeah. So wow. These kids were very talented. And that Hawaii team, I did a study on them because we were going to go over and do a camp in Hawaii. Gil Patterson, Oakland A's pitching coordinator, because the first baseman's coach dad wanted us to come over because they don't get a lot of, being off the mainland, these kids were talented. And the president of the league kind of stopped it, unfortunately. And I followed these kids who were super talented, and two of them played in college out of that whole group of Hawaii too. So there's those times that you still need to be developed, and you need to have proper coaching. And even though they excelled and won the Little League World Series at age 12, that really is eye-opening that only two played college baseball.
Wow. So if you just joined us, we're talking with Joe Spurley. He's the author of Athlete's Guide to Success, A Roadmap to Becoming a Champion. And he's with us here to answer all of our questions about playing sports at various levels, such as high school, college, and pro. And you've got so much information here. It's such a great book. So thank you for being with us. We're going to keep going here. And one of the questions we have for you is, what's your why? Why do you do what you do? What's your love of baseball? Why do you love baseball so much? What's your story?
I think for me, it was a big passion, that I developed at age five, really baseball, basketball, and football. I was always outside, playing those sports, was something that it just really was able to naturally, it came to me, and I really had a great, times playing that. And then, after losing my mom, finding her passed at age 11, and my dad already had some diabetes issues and some PTSD issues from World War II. Plus, I later, didn't know at the time, found out his mom died when he was six, and he had two older brother had appendicitis and died, and two younger sisters that died. So he had a lot of childhood trauma. And then his dad, at age 21, when he was 21, my grandfather had remarried because his first wife had died and had eight kids. They had 17 kids. And then he got bit by a mosquito, and they didn't know, thought it was the flu, and ended up being, encephalitis, and he passed. So my dad was supposed to take over this huge farming operation. And then he got drafted to World War II. So the whole bottom fell out of it. But that was a lot of passed on dysfunctionalism that, I wasn't aware of that at the time, and losing my mom, and then my dad pretty much had a lot of, war issues and diabetes and became disabled. And so for me, it was a big part of my safe haven was being on the baseball fields, the basketball courts and the football field, to where I could really, focus and not think about, those trauma childhood, having to deal with, the parents losing my parents. It was a huge thing that I was able to block out, and really was, too traumatic that I couldn't even deal with it. There was times I remember reading books. I finally started to, deal with it, but it's always been a great part of my life. So, as we all have life journeys and we have lessons, just like you, Elizabeth, you're doing with some of your, things with your peanut allergies, we all go down a path it's been a passion of mine to use my experience, because I really, of all the sports I played, I had three good coaches I talk about in that, and there's a shortage of coaches that know how to identify, develop, and lead athletes in today's world. That's a very important thing that parents should understand, and I really kind of just, been on a mission to do that and be that coach that can, I think a great way to say is an excellent coach is hard to find, difficult to part with, and impossible to forget.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. I love that. And how do you spot a bad coach? because you might not, as parents, we might not see that, or a child might not see that coming into a program. How do you see that or spot it? What are there things you're supposed to look for?
Yeah, right. I wrote about some of the things in the book. Few of the things that really tip it off is when they really have a demeanor when they step on the field, that they turn into somebody that's really a different person than what you see, and you can see that they're driven to win, and they're really not thinking of the players. And when they start saying, you know, my team won, and then they start, you know, and when you get points, they start saying we're number three in the state. And, you know, and it ends up being, you can see where it's more of their fulfillment. You got to really watch and understand. And if they aren't really playing players a certain way, and they're just putting a, you know, person to pitch every game or catch, and they're not, your son or daughter is not having fun, make sure you communicate with them to understand. And you get to know and watch these coaches, because, you know, sometimes it's hard to figure out, but then sometimes you do. And then some parents are like, you know, they don't want to, you know, make a change. They don't want to kind of uproot and, you know, for whatever reason. And I say, you're the one that has to make the decision here, because your child doesn't know, you know, they maybe know a little bit, but now you've got to see what's happened here, and you need to, you know, either have a talk with the coach or find another team. You know, that I think is a very good question, Elizabeth, because I think a lot of times parents are having them on these teams, and it's happening in all sports, and they don't really know that things are happening until it's kind of too late, where the child says, I'm no longer playing. And, you know, there's a lot of false hope at times that's giving, that they need to understand when somebody's saying, you know, well, play on my team and I'll get you a college scholarship. You know, that should never be. All, you know, over 300 I help, I've never once said that. You can't promise, no matter how good they are, you can't promise them that if they play on your team, you're going to get them a college scholarship.
Yeah. You know, on the flip side too, sometimes there's just some really lovely actual people out there that are coaches, and they're just not that great at coaches. They might just not know the sport as well as they need to at that level or whatever. I mean, there's some genuinely lovely people out there. You know what I mean? They're just nice. And
right.
They just might right. not be they're, effective they're, coaching.
Right. I mean, I talk about in the book that it's a very hard thing it's a lot easier to play the sport than it is to coach a sport. You know, there was a time I coached with a Cy Young winner, Major League Cy Young winner, you know, had set a record of winning the games. And, he would come to me, and he didn't even know how to like pick players. It was a professional team. He one time said to me, he said, you know, Joe, I know how to throw fastball and curveball, but I don't know how to teach it. He said, my 12-year-old, 10-year-old, I tried working with him, and I can't. He says, can you work with them? And I said, yeah. So parents have to understand that a lot of times it's a very hard thing to do. It's kind of a born and learned thing that you to be able to take somebody and see their strengths and weaknesses and be able to, you know, have them improve and develop. It's a rare things. When you think about how many NFL and NBA and Major League managers were fired in the last 3 years, I write about that in the book, and they're given, you know, drafting and giving some of the trading for some of the best players, and they're not able to put it together. It's a difficult thing to do, but there is guys, you know, that are able to do it. And when you do find that, you really want to, you know, stay with them that have the ability to look at strengths and weaknesses, and it's about development, you know, mentally and physically, and developing character, you know, skills and life skills. You know, the best coaches, you know, as we hear John Wooden, and there's many of these coaches, Vince Lombardi, that really instilled, when you hear their players talk about them later on, they were like an uncle or stepdad to them.
Right. You know, think about the best teacher you've ever had, and now think about the worst teacher you've ever had, and think about them each being your coach in the sport that you're playing, you know, and
right.
Think of it like that, because it really is hard to find people. I like that, what you said, to identify, develop, and then lead the athlete those are powerful things.
Yeah, that's a very important thing that they should write. So the parents who are listening and athletes should write that down, and just have that on the fridge. Identify, develop, and lead athletes is what you're looking for.
Well, I saw, you know, and I won't name names here, but I recently came across a couple coach profiles. And I saw one who said, I'm the greatest person to ever put this jersey on. That was in the coach profile. I'm like, yeah. I want to play for you. And the other one I saw, and it went on and on and on. That was just the tip of the bio. And the other one was a list of every single player that he's ever helped to the, you know, just like collecting accolades, you know, every single player that he's ever helped go here or go there, and the win record and the, like, collecting the stats under the coach.
Yeah.
And it was not, it wasn't about, it's mind boggling to me, because there's a lot of kids looking, and maybe they're the best coach ever. I don't know who they are. I just saw the bios and it was instantly a flip of the switch to me, like, ah, because it wasn't about anybody but them.
That's a very good point, you know, and when you ask about how do you find the best coaches are the ones that understand that it's about the players and it's not about them. You know, we all like to win and like to be competitive. And, you know, we don't step on the field. But at the end of the day, you know, I've played in all over and won national championships, won awards. That's something else to look for in coaches. That a lot of times there's unfulfilled things and frustrations in coaches, and then they start to want to, they really become self-centered and they want the accolades.
But can you imagine playing for a coach who said, I'm the, why would you put a jersey on? If you're the best one to ever put the jersey on, why am I putting this on? I don't get it.
Yeah. Yeah. The stuff I've heard over the years, I had one guy tell me his junior in high school, he got cut, and his high school coach called him in and cut him. And he said, you're an athlete. You're not an athlete and you never will be one. I went, wow. How do you crush a boy like that? So thank goodness I was able to get a hold of him. And, you know, I said, you know, we're going to get you to college, and it may not be where you want to go, but you know, if you work harder in 2 years, and then we're gonna send him some tickets and tell him to come see if you're an athlete now. And he did.
Proof's in the pudding, huh?
There's so many. You can't crush somebody like that. There's stuff going on out there. I just can't imagine how anybody could say something like that. But you know, it's just kind of the coaching sometimes is learned behavior that they got from their father or their coaches beforehand. So kind of dysfunctional thing that, you know, we all run into. All of us have never had a perfect functional life. We've had some dysfunction, but I think sometimes it comes out in the coaching world of the past learned behavior from their coach or their father.
Yeah. So, I'm going to shift gears a little bit on you here and go to this multi-sport idea, because we've got multiple questions. When people knew you were coming here, people have asked multiple questions here. If you're a baseball player and your whole goal is to get a baseball scholarship, you know, you got goals, dreams, whatever vision that you've got in your head, why would you go and play, you know, soccer or football or basketball? Why would you derail that one track mission?
You would do that because of the overuse injuries that have been by these orthopedic surgeons, you know, like Dr. James Andrews and others. Orthopedics have statistics that show playing one sport, you know, just one sport almost year round, increases your chances of injury by 70%. You also have a high chance of burnout, and you also are not cross training and getting stronger drills. Like when I would play football, you know, the stretching that we did and the running that we did really kind of worked for baseball and basketball. And then when I got into basketball, doing a lot of the, you know, the crunchers and the cardio really helped come in the spring for my physical strength, plus my mental, you know, getting away from it. You know, at the end of 3 months of football, I was tired. I was like, this, you know, I would love it at the beginning, but 3 months, I'm like, I'm done with this game, you know. And then you go on to basketball, and you're excited, and then you play 3 months, and you're like, who was baseball here yet? You know, and so the end coaches, including, I talk about, you know, Vanderbilt, baseball coach who's, you know, the number one, they won 2 years ago. They recruit two sport athletes, over one sport athletes. And Pete Carroll, used to be the USC football coach, said that he recruited two sport athletes, players. He even pushed for athletes in college to play two sports, which in this day and age is really very rare to see that. Years ago, we used to have some of those extreme natural talent athletes that would play two, three sports, like Dave Winfield in some of these. But, you know, that is a really thing that the parents have to listen to those things, because those statistics and what I just said, as I said about the NFL also, that, you know, the 226 and the 250 all played more than one sport in youth and in high school.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm thinking about Cam playing soccer, and that, and that was quite something to see Cameron play soccer, and he will to this day roll his eyes, but he can't. Yeah. That's what Cam did too on his breaks. Not so much in high school, cause he was really busy academically and stuff, but I'm thinking back, he played basketball, soccer, baseball. But yeah, soccer was not his jam at all. What about the exhaustion factor there with playing three sports? Is there any argument there that, you know, maybe, you know, that you look at your child and go, wow, you are so extremely overscheduled and overworking your body and overusing everything? Is there any argument there?
I think, you know, on what's happening now is that at the before the high school level is a lot of the boys and girls are playing two sports at once. I even just heard last week a 12-year-old, he's playing three sports right now at once, which is crazy. Yeah. There's a lot of them doing that at younger age. The parents feel that they need to be playing on this because the other ones are doing that for them. They don't want to get behind, but that's totally affecting their schoolwork, their homework, their physical exhaustion. They're going to put themselves chance of getting more injured. So you should play other sports during the year, but never play two sports at once. And then, you know, take a little break during the holidays or whenever, and just, you know, not play for a couple weeks, but you should definitely not play two sports at once. You know, some guys I when doing lessons would leave my instruction and go to like, you know, football or you know, soccer or lacrosse practice, and they were just totally exhausted. And you know, and in this case, I remember the one left going to football in the spring. They had full pad spring football practice after they had played in the winter, and he played in high school, and that was it. He was done. He played baseball, but he should have. He was one of the top pitchers in the state of Arizona when he was 11, and he just got burnt out and overuse. He did get some elbow issues, which he fought through after his 12-year-old year, but in high school he was a very good player, but he told his dad, I'm done, you know. And you're seeing that a lot. It's just because this guy was just, he played baseball more than anything, but he shouldn't have been playing, you know, two sports at once like that. This generation is, this parents seem, you know, that's a big thing I would really stress parents and listeners is don't have them play two sports at one time.
Seems excessive. I know when I was thinking back to the cross training elements of different sports, because I was a gymnast at the age of three, and what they used to do to help us with, you know, developmentally as a gymnast was they would place you in ballet, tap, jazz to kind of complement everything and stretch different muscles and so forth. But I really feel you when the ballet class was over, I'm like, okay, thank you. Not a ballerina.
Yeah. And you do figure that out later on that it's not something, but you want to give your boy or girl, you know, chances to play sports, you know, that they, you know, seem to enjoy having fun and they're developing, you know, and kind of, you know, guiding them in that realm, and instead of getting, you know, caught up in trying to specialize at you know, a lot of times now at, you know, at 8-year-old, they have these tournament teams in almost all sports, and you know, you shouldn't be traveling around and playing a tournament team and having gone every weekend when you're 7-8 years old, you know.
Oh, come on, isn't the MLB there watching?
That's the chances of them ever making it to the MLB are maybe a 1 in a million when you do that, you know. It just doesn't work that way in trying to get that contract and that signing bonus, you know. It
does.
The other thing is, yeah, exactly. That that I remember the 12-year-old group that made it to on ESPN that I was talking about played Hawaii in the semifinals at San Bernardino, California. A lot of the parents were like, they changed the lineup, so some parents weren't upset that their son wasn't going to get to be on ESPN. And I said to him, look, I'll promise you that there's nobody here right now in 6 years will remember that your son did or did not play on ESPN. And exactly right, because that was the group that Walker had played against. And I think it was two or three of them went on and played in college, and the rest never played after high school. Some didn't even play in high school because they went and played on tournament teams and stopped playing when they were 15, 16 or got cut.
Yeah. So let's go back to this mentor thing, because in I believe really wholeheartedly, like one of my mentors, I consider you a mentor for me, because you've placed networking opportunities in front of me. Like I think you're on the lookout for everyone. A lot of the times you connect those dots. And one of my mentors is Sally Huss, and I'm so grateful that I know her because of you. Can you talk about the importance of paying attention to older people? And I'm going to say it just like that.
Yeah, I think it's a very important thing to really listen and learn from somebody like Sally that has incredible amount of life experiences and talent as a tennis player and as an artist and as a children's illustrator, books that just, I remember the first time, seeing her painting that in La Jolla on the sidewalk, and just the gift that she had of in her paintings just exuded passion and love, and then going into her gallery and I could just feel, she didn't even tell me at that time when I first that she was a tennis, ex-Wellington tennis champion. But I knew there was something where we connected that was really unique about her. And I think it's very important. I can't stress enough for parents and the boys and girls to be open-minded and be very wanting to learn and from these people like Sally and people that have been down the path of life and have a lot of great wisdom and experiences that, are priceless, that you can learn from, and you don't have to go down that path.
Make mistakes.
I say, I want the athletes to have a great life developing experiences and go down that path and have great life and find that what they want, rather than having many of them go down that untraveled path and don't have a mentor, or they're not listening, and then they find out at the end of that path there was a landmine. And their life has negatively been affected. And we really want to help. We don't want sports to have a negative impact in a life. It had a positive impact in my life, and I know Cam has had some, and there's been many, many that will tell you they had positive life. But there's too many that I saw that are not having positive life developing experiences.
I have friends with kids who play, and they're just like, I have friends whose kids who play, and the stories of the playing experience at college makes me want to cry, because their moments. I don't know if everybody always realizes that you can't get the moments back. So how you spend your moments in the moments really super matters. And it's, I don't know if people pause enough to really, I don't think sometimes coaches go, I'm going to ensure all 50 people on this team have a great college experience, anything like, I don't know if they have time for that.
No, you're right. You hit on something very important that I think that life goes by so fast. And as parents, your son and daughter, next thing you know, you blink. So you really want to, enjoy those times with them and support them to a point, in trying to guide them. And that's where the ones that I've been able to help to go on to be successful in high school, college, and professionally are the ones where the player was really coachable and really was respectful. He wanted to learn. And the parents, I had to do a lot of mentoring and guiding, because, not every game is going to be, you're going to get to play, So a lot of what I did was also mentoring the parents, because sometimes they get more frustrated when the child's younger than the child does, because the child doesn't really see it, And I've heard that from parents. They're like, I think I get more upset than, you know, my son does. And I said, no, I said, what you have to remember is they're just holding it in. And that's another good thing I want to address, is that I've had players now that are older that have come back to me and now have had things that they saw of having too many on a team, you know, 20 on a team, and they were being taken advantage of, that they're now have, you know, some deep wounds that their parents thought that really didn't affect them, but it did. These boys and girls are brilliant these days, and they pick up on things real quickly. They just don't say anything. They hold those in, and those, they need to communicate things to their parents so that they don't have that at the end. You know, the one thing that I really hate hearing is when they're like, you know, I wish I wouldn't have quit. You know, I wish I'd have kept playing. And that's where, listeners out there, do not quit. Please, if your son or daughter saying they want to quit, you know, just, you know, I'll give my email at the end and send an email, and you know, we will do anything we can, because I've heard too many parents and now getting players coming back there in college saying, you know, I wish I would have kept playing. I wish I would have listened, you know, and I wish, you know, we would have stayed with you and, you know, had you do more coaching with us. Because a lot of times when they beer on these tournament teams, if another bad sign of a coach is if a coach is not letting your son or daughter go do instruction with somebody else and tell them that they need to do instruction with you, that's a red flag. That's controlling, and that's insecuring, and you shouldn't allow that. That's a common thing that goes on that I saw, is that they like to have these tournament teams, but the coaches don't understand that it's not about them, and they worry about getting overshadowed. They don't want to have somebody show them up, which realistically is a red flag, because then it's about them, and the parents feel like they're stuck and they need to find another team. If they're having success working with somebody or a coach, and this team they're playing on says you cannot go have instruction with them, that immediately they should say they're going to go to that coach, and because the parent should be controlling the destiny rather than the coach somewhat in that case.
You know, we can't cover every scenario here because we're the best ever you show, and we've got about an hour or so, but I am going to tell everybody the name of your book again, then I've got a couple more questions here. So we're talking live with Joe Spurley, he's the author of The Athlete's Guide to Success, A Roadmap to Becoming a Champion. And at the end of the show, we're going to hear all about how Joe founded the Freedom Pro Baseball Minor League in Phoenix, Arizona too. So Joe, be prepared to talk about that. But a couple more scenarios for you here. Can you talk of two things, and if you want to do both, please do, but I want to talk about horrendous team behavior off the field and how that affects on-field play, and then I also would love to talk about another scenario of parents living vicariously through their children. Which one? Do you like those topics, or would you like to talk about something else?
Yeah, I think I have a chapter in that I write, you know, in chapter 6 is, you know, things for parents, you know, to understand about their child playing sports and to not live vicariously, you know, through your unfulfilled playing days that, you know, many parents had played sports. So that does put pressure on, and the son and the daughter see that so much, and they can feel that. I remember times doing instruction and the dad or mom would come up and start to watch a little, and the boy would completely change because he was feeling pressure from the parent that, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. They know if they're so wise, they know if you're living through them, and the chances of them ever going, you know, past where you went are slim because of that. So it's best just to let that go and enjoy the great days of watching them on the field and just, you know, just win or lose, you know, off the field, just, you know, be thankful for that great day and just go if they want to go eat, and just don't mention anything about the game. A lot of parents, you know, will bring up things in the car on the ride, you know, about what they did, you know, they didn't get a hit or they did this wrong. And, you know, don't talk about that at all. Just let it all go. And if the child brings it up, the boy or the girl, something about the game, then you can start to talk. But I think it's best just to really, you know, let them have fun and not feel pressure and that you're living through them. the other part about, you know, off the field, you know, actions and disrespecting people and, you know, no gratitude. You know, I think two very important traits that are really lacking. We need to see more gratitude in our use and more respect. And when you're not doing those two things, you're only hurting yourself, and you're never going to be able to advance to where you should be with that type of mindset. You should always respect and give gratitude for people that have done things for you, no matter what it is, coaches, parents, uncles, aunts, yeah. Anything, and never be that cancer person that you see that where they get upset and they start thinking boys like to sometimes be funny and they'll make a comment and the other boy will laugh. And then it gets very contagious and it hurts the morale of the team. And, you know, an athlete that sees that should put a stop to that and be a leader and say, that's not what we do when we're off the field or on the field. We have the same type of attitude and character and integrity that we need to show when we're on the field, because it is two very important things. And I know you talk a lot about gratitude, and I think there's a lot of stuff out there that I have studied it also, and there's proven studies that if you do not have gratitude, the chances of you ever having a fulfilled, good life and doing what you love to do passion-wise is very rare.
Yeah, there's a difference between ambition and like a conscious ambition, I think, and one is gratitude-based. Right. The other thing too is what about this idea of, you know, having a clean and sober and drug-free, you know, season, or what is with the substance abuse, I'm going to call it, for lack of a probably yep. maybe a better term, maybe you can fix that if it needs to be fixed. With teams in college and so forth, how can teams right. be in season drinking, and where is the monitoring of the drug use and pot use and juuling right. and all this stuff? How is that? I have a couple questions. So this is I'm putting my mom hat on for a minute here and mm-hmm. my best ever mm-hmm. you hat combined. Sorry, but how is mm-hmm. it? How does your body function properly as a college athlete with all that crap in it?
Right. It's a very good question. I think, you know, one of the things that kind of is a sign of, you know, our times now with, yeah, a lot of the studies of COVID now and the things, the depression and the teenage groups and things, it's kind of been a thing where it's a coping mechanism that a lot of boys and girls are using for, you know, some, you know, childhood dysfunctional or trauma, you know, not having, you know, something, some good parental leadership there, and going down a path of seeing that this alcohol or drug kind of takes them out of that pain and that numbness, and then it becomes an addiction and they're not even aware of it, and they're using it to actually start, you know, to compete, to help with their you know, their emotions and their nervousness. So I think it is more, as you mentioned, prevalent than ever, but it has to be, it's a tough thing to monitor as a coach, because when they start to get into college and professionally, you know, a lot of them are 21 and it's very tough to, you know, you have to, if you're on the road, you have to definitely do, you know, bed checks in a hotel, and you have to, you know, monitor them. But I think that there needs to be more drug testing in the colleges. You know, we'll talk a little bit about the Freedom League, and I was, you know, had issues with players, you know, with marijuana, but it is a very tough thing right now. And I think there's more than we actually know it. And it's something in them usually that has led them to that point of using the alcohol or drug as a coping mechanism. And of course, just wanting to have fun and party and let everything go. and not think about anything. And you know, in the college age, that's been going on for years. But I think more of the there's just more drug opioid use that is it hooks them that we never had when we were younger. That these opioids that are basically were painkillers. You know, back in used to be Darvon and there was Valium things. Now the similar type drug, but they put these euphoria type drugs in besides the pain killing, which hooks the boy or girl or young man and young woman taking it to where their body they then need it because it gives them a great you know uplifting feeling that they were never able to have. So it's a big problem, I think, and the drug companies have put these type of euphoria, you know, mental state into the drugs that creates the high addiction rate that we have. And, yeah. And you know, I think there's a high marijuana usage right now too. Also that realistically, if you do studies on marijuana, it slows down your reflexes. You become, you know, lopey, you eat a lot. It's not helping where a lot of some think, well, it's better than drinking alcohol. But when you really do studies on it, it does a major effect on your synapses, your brain, your reflexes, you know, everything that I think a lot of them aren't aware of. And it helps them cope with day-to-day things because I think a lot of athletes with the pressure they have and, you know, each individual life that they've led, have had, you know, some things that are deep wounds that they don't ever get healed.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, well, so thank you for that. Just touching on that, because I know we had that come in as a question. And then I guess two final things. We have a question about player attitude. This one came in a few days ago with someone who knew that you were going to be on the show, and they were trying to, I don't know how to, I'm not going to ask this exactly the way it was asked, but so I'm going to rephrase it and have you help here a little bit. But they were asking about why, what's with the ego in players, and how do you spot that, a player who's in it for like ego and all this stuff versus a player who's in it for genuine, I guess is the way.
Yeah, that's a very good question. Yeah. I think one of the things that starts to show on the ego side is that they really start to make comments and show things that it's really about them and they really don't care about their teammates and their team. You know, I had one guy, was pitching a no-hitter in a Freedom League and came in the dugout and some of the guys were not paying attention. And I said, you know, guys, let's focus here. He's got a great game, no hitter. And one of the guys said, I don't care. And boy, that I had a quite the talk with him afterwards about that. Cause I could see him starting to veer that way, but he let out, you know, that, so it is something that somewhat is come from, you know, learned behavior of television and, you know, internet and watching, you know, NBA, NFL, you know, Major League Baseball players, some of them, you know, they start to think that they're bigger than the game. And that's some of the reasons why a lot of the good colleges and professional teams don't have your last name on your back, because you're not playing for your name. You're playing for the team and the name that's on the front of the jersey. And I think that's really needs to be instilled and understand that this is, you know, not totally about you. It's about this team, or it's about the school that you're representing, or the professional team you're representing, that you're not bigger than the game. And you have to make sure as a coach to stop that. And sometimes they don't. I've had to, where I had to release some because they just don't listen. Right. It's like, you know, you're not going to get through to him. And I could see why the Colorado, in this instance, I'm thinking of why the Colorado Rockies released him after 2 years when he had the skills. He was a prime example of that. It was ego and it was about him. And he would change for a little bit on the stuff that I would show him, because he always try to make flashy plays at shortstop, but he would always make bad throws that would really hurt the pitcher at the time and the team during the end of the game. So it's something that I think is a lot of learned behavior that really has to be stopped at a young age, because I think sometimes parents let that go and you have to, stop that. I remember one player, one of the first ones I worked with, he was starting to do really good. And he was getting to the point where he was getting that testosterone and that male macho. And he was, dad was kind of living through him. I was coaching, getting ready for high school. We did a little team in the fall, and he hit a ball that went. It didn't go out, and then he stopped at third, and I was coaching third, and he said, I knew it wasn't going to go out. I said, you're not Babe Ruth. And he, Babe Ruth pointed to when he was going to hit a home run. And so I had to really cut him down and get him to realize, and I also had to talk with his parents that, we need to get a hold of him, because his ego, and I'm not going to coach anybody, no matter as much as I've spent time with him and think he's a great, you're going to be a great young man. But we need to get that under control. And I had a meeting with parents. And
sentence removed.
Yep. sentence removed. Because he did the same thing. The other thing that was interesting, I had to, he was doing similar things at shortstop. He was trying to, make flashy plays and making bad throws, but, trying to be real, highlight real plays but he wasn't that good to make those plays. So he made one time. And I said, where did you learn to do that? He said, Derek, Derek Jeter. And I said, I'm going to be better than Derek Jeter. I said, you will never be better than Derek Jeter. I had to cut him down, because there's no way. I mean, Derek Jeter, if anybody knows the New York Yankees, only got hit 3,000. He used to make incredible plays. And I know guys that coached him, and he put immense amount of hours into getting where he was. Plus, he was amazingly, gifted and talented. But and then his dad came to me afterwards and said, why did you say that to them? I said, Gary, we can't let him go with that attitude. You've been beefing him up, and you've been pumping him up so much. I had to chop him down, because I had to be truthful with him when you haven't been truthful, that, he's definitely going to go on and play college, but he is not going to be better than Derek Jeter,
Yeah, truthful is interesting.
We can't let that ego go, because he was at that age where he actually thought it in his mind, because of what was his playing and what his parents were telling him and others, that he was going to be better than Derek Jeter. He actually thought he was.
Yeah. I get it. Okay, two more things. I keep saying that, but I'm going to keep you a little bit more here.
That's okay.
What about the feeling, you're on a team, let's say, and you haven't played, you just are not playing, not at all. And you're like, well, why did I come to this college? I haven't played at all. How do you find your value in that circumstance?
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's very hard.
You thought you were going to play, but you're not.
Yeah, I just had a player that went through that I want to share, kind of try and get the short version of it. He was referred to me. He was a player out of Tucson, Arizona, was an all-star high school player, and then got recruited to go to Trinity in San Antonio and play. And his freshman year, he didn't hardly get to play at all. And there was about three guys in that team that I had actually worked with individually, before him in when they were little league and maybe middle school. And then his mom and his himself was really, and dad were frustrated that they wanted to transfer schools, and he was going to pre-med, and he really was, I knew from the first time I did instruction, he really had a very good intelligence. He absorbed a lot of things. He was very astute, and everything I showed him, he picked up on. Well, he ended up that summer, similar to Walker, I got him on a summer collegiate team, and he did well. And then a sophomore year, he went back and he didn't hardly get to play, and they won the Division III national championship. So his mom was really upset that, the coach would put him in, and then he'd get a couple hits, or score the winning run in a four-game series, he'd get to play, and then all of a sudden he wouldn't play him. And it's just some things that are so difficult as a athlete and as a parent to really sit back. And in this case, we just kept, getting better, improving, keep working on things, which is very hard to do, when you get kind of shown by the coach that they really don't have the use for you other than a certain spot. It's a very difficult thing, but I think in this case, it worked out for him to stay at the school. Now, every case is different. I think you have to really come to a point early on. You should see signs, parents, in their freshman year, that there's things there that you can see that just aren't going to change. You know, there's a lot of coaches that, you know, that won't change. You know, the old saying, you can't teach an old dog new tricks, you know. So when you initially, parents, you see this is in their first year, start to, you know, make some calls, or, you know, you can reach out, send me an email, start to do things. But in this guy's case, it worked for him that I kept the parents and him going positively and not quitting, and, you know, just, you know, wanting to keep playing baseball because he had a passion. And he ended up finally as senior, he got to play. And then, he said, and that's something for the parents also that I said to him, is that, you know, you've got plenty of years to work. You know, parents sometimes they're like, well, we want to get them a job and get them off our payroll or get them off our, you know, but they got plenty of time to work. If they really have the passion and they have, you know, the talent, and in this case, he really worked hard and he could really hit, that I really mentored him and instilled things in him to keep going, and then helped him fulfill that by really only playing his senior year. He got 2 minor league independent league offers, which was incredible, with not even going to the tryouts. And a lot of times you have to go and they want to see you physically, but from things he was a great example of working hard and listening and learning to things I was telling him to do. And then I even mentored him what to say when he was calling these general managers. And for him to get 2 offers of a contract without even, you know, not being a major league, you know, minor league affiliated player and not having much college playing time, it was a great, you know, story that it's going to change his life forever. He's leaving on Sunday to the United Shore Professional League up by Detroit. But in his case, it worked that he stayed there at the time. But I think, it's something that you have to have somebody talking with you and helping you and, you know, mentoring you, and also weighing things out, all your options, you know, at the freshman year. If the end of freshman year, things don't feel right, you need to start really looking at your options and, you know, finding people that can open doors and have some relationships and understand, can make calls. 'Cause a lot of times for the parents, it's hard to do. So you need to find somebody that can do that, because the worst thing you can do is stay there and be held back, because that, you know, you don't want to be under somebody's thumb. And I think that does happen a lot, Elizabeth.
Yeah. Okay. So now we're going to talk about the Freedom Pro Baseball League. We'll finish up our show with this, because you really have, you've done something remarkable. And I would just love for you to tell us about what you did there with the baseball league and why you did that too.
Yeah, it was something that, you know, from all the years of playing and then, you know, being around, seeing that there was a need for opportunity and development after college. You know, I always wanted the guys, when I saw the vision, you know, one of the first things that I saw years ago was the St. Paul Saints, and I was involved with them, and then the Fargo-Moorhead Redhawks, and was really, it started to set in my mind of things that I could do that would change the game and bring it back like it used to be, and then give opportunities for players and coaches and even staff, and then develop and have that chance to go on and be signed by a major league team. So it was a whole vision I had from the time, you know, I was younger till, you know, playing through things and seeing things that a lot of times a person just needs an opportunity and a door to open. So it was a huge undertaking actually, we were just going to do one team in a league that was operating independently, that was operating for quite a while. And they had teams in the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. And then I started to see things that they weren't doing ethically, and they weren't really they were taking advantage of guys that wanted to own teams and didn't see the philosophy that I had, and were bringing back guys that were ex-major league guys that were troublemakers like Jose Canseco, and you know, some of those, they were bringing them back to manage and play. They would play also, and so I started to put it all together and saw that we had these great stadiums, you know, Phoenix, with that major league stadiums that are set vacant after the Giants, A's, Mariners, and Padres and Indians, you know, all leave in April. And so I started to put it all together, about 2 years of just meeting to get some of those stadiums. And then we launched the press release once I got the lease signed at Scottsdale Stadium. And the guy that was running this other league had sent out a schedule to the other teams in the team in Edmonton, Oilers, who had a good successful organization and also on the Edmonton Oilers hockey team. They saw the press release of the Freedom League starting up, and they then figured out that, you know, the guys that they're involved with, and they pulled out of the league. And before we even played a game, that whole unethical league folded. So it was pretty amazing of how even playing a game, I knew the guy even called me and asked if I wanted to get in. He'd let me in with no franchise fee. And I said, no, we're okay. We're going to do this, you know, the way that we feel is right. And so it was a lot of great, I mean, times, you know, of players that just, I mean, one that I always like to share great stories of one that was worth all the hours that it took to put into it and the years is, there are probably some listeners have heard of the movie Moneyball. There's a book, Moneyball. It was done. Billy Beane, the Oakland A's, had come up with a concept and hired Harvard statisticians to keep the payroll low and select the best players that will play for less salary. And one of his picks, second round pick, was a guy by the name of Steve Stanley. He went to Notre Dame and he had called him and said, you know, if you want to be a second round pick, you know, we'd love to, we think you're what we want to put in, you know, and he's in the book Moneyball, and in the movie when Brad Pitt talked to Theo Epstein, he said, we'll trade you Steve Stanley. So he's mentioned in both the movie and the book. And then he said, yeah, of course, you know, and took less, and then was got married and had a daughter, and then was on the road and worked his way up to AAA in Sacramento, and they wanted him to change and be a home run hitter. And he's 5'8" and 160, and he was drafted and he played, and was his strong point was just to be able to, you know, hit and get on base. And he was a good defensive player. So he was getting frustrated, and they demoted him to Double A, and he asked for his release. He didn't see a thing. So he started an insurance business in Scottsdale. And then about 5 years later, after he had three daughters now, he felt that God was leading him to make a comeback. And he called up Keith Lippman, the Oakland A's minor league player development, who I just was there like a week before, and told Keith after spring training that year, if they have any players that they release, which they do every spring, to if they have, you know, want to continue their career, to have them call me. So he called up Keith and he said, Keith, do you think you have room for a 29-year-old center fielder? And he said, Steve, I don't think so. But to call me, because I was putting together the Freedom, you know, minor league independent league. So he called me. I didn't know him at this time, but then he left a message and had a conversation with him and had him come out to trout. He didn't even have, Elizabeth, he didn't even have a glove. He gave it all away. He signed it, gave it all away. He had nothing. And he shows up with a borrowed glove and he bought some batting gloves, and he could still had some play. He could play. So I sat him down, and most of the guys that I was looking at signing were going to be right out of college. I wanted 22, 23, 24, and he was 29, 30 then, and really was a good, you know, type captain. So I said, how about if you be the captain and then the chaplain and do services on Sunday? He said, that's perfect. That's exactly what I wanted to do with the A's, but they wouldn't let me. So he ended up just really doing well. And now his three daughters and his wife got to come to every game. And when we traveled a little bit up to Prescott, they would come up there, and they just – so we did the kid caster. Then, you know, they have kids get up there, and his 9-year-old now is doing a kid caster, and they usually give him three outs. At the end of the three outs, she goes, oh, dang, my dad didn't do that. Oh, sorry, folks. She didn't know she had the speaker on. She said, come back tomorrow night. Have a good night. So I was just laughing at third base thinking, this is great. So I went down and I called my staff and I said, tomorrow night, have her do the kid cast where dad bats. So next night she gets up there and her dad comes walking up the plate, and she just, I mean, it was just, I wish I had it on video. She's like, now batting number five, my dad, Steve Stanley. He was laughing so hard he couldn't even hit. But he was laughing, looking up in the press box, and I was just standing there at third base coach and thinking, you know, all this was just a great, one of those great stories that we had. And he was just a model player and ended up got to see every game. And then a teammate of his was running a team in Wichita and called me and saw he'd been hitting 300 and wanted to know if he'd love to have him at the league ending for their tournament. And it would be a little reunite with him being a teammate. So I said, absolutely. So they, all four of them, three girls and his wife and him, jumped in the car and drove from Phoenix all the way to Wichita straight through and played in the league ending championship and ended up going all the way up to Winnipeg and won, got into the league championship with that league. So he said, I had him do some video for a documentary work. And he said that year was the most fun he's had ever in playing all those years of baseball. And I thought, you know, that was one of the main reasons why I wanted to bring back the game the way it used to be, for love of the game. The families get to come to the game. You know, you're not on the road traveling so much. A lot of things I learned that weren't good about the game, we brought back the great part of the game.
Yep, the heart is in it.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I've kept you way over, but it's been such a lovely conversation.
That's okay.
We do have to go now, though, but yeah. I thank you for being here with us on the Best Ever You Show. Thank you for all your wisdom. Thank you for such a wonderful book. And I think everybody will enjoy this show. So thank you for being here. And it's Joe Spurley.
Yes, I really...
Sorry.
Right. I was just going to add that in. I really appreciate it. It's been, you know, really great to, you know, to be on your show. I know you guys have really done a lot of things, have a heart and passion to get the, you know, as your best ever you. So, you know, people can go on my website and there's my emails on there and send me any questions, anything. You know, for me, the more, I think the world is a lot better, Elizabeth, if we can have our boys and girls and young men and young women continue to play and have positive life developing experiences and do not, you know, let that stop from a bad situation.
Perfect. All right. Thank you so much for being here. And thank you all for listening.
Thank you for listening. We're so glad you tuned in. Be brave, be bold, be you. And remember to visit us at besteveryou.com.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.